Energy and Climate Finance to order. Welcome you all on this rainy day. We have minutes, we do have a quorum. We have minutes from March 12th. Representative Stevenson?
Madam Chair, I move approval of the minutes from March 12th.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. He's moved the minutes for March 12th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Minutes are adopted. Welcome to Representative Richardson. I'm going to move your House file 2218 and that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2218 would require utilities and certain grantees to submit annual diversity reports. We all know that energy is important to the world, our country, and our state. It's one of the key industries impacting economic development. Having a diverse workforce is key to a healthy sector. We have had the opportunity to start important conversations with the utilities, and we're looking forward to working with them on this initiative and talking through further refinements to explore opportunities. I'm appreciative of the time they spent with me and look forward to working together. As a critical first step, we need to pay attention, and this bill serves as a way to start a conversation by gathering contracting and employment data on demographics like race, gender, and also veteran data as well. It can help highlight opportunities for outreach and increase participation, which will in turn increase competition, lower prices, and improve quality. I've worked to bring federal dollars to the state to introduce foster youth, youth with disabilities, indigenous youth, and youth of color to early exposure to STEM careers as early as age 12. And an early introduction before high school to these careers can be an important part of the solution when we're thinking about diversifying our workforce. We have a real opportunity before us to create win-win situations and to ensure equitable access to these opportunities. And with that, I will introduce our next testifier, Madam Chair, if that's okay, Ben Passer from Fresh Energy.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Wagenius and committee members. My name is Ben Passer, and I'm the Director of Energy Access and Equity at Fresh Energy. As an independent energy policy nonprofit that is working to advance equitable outcomes across Minnesota's energy sector, Fresh Energy appreciates the concepts that are put on the table in this bill. In times of dramatic and transformational change in the energy sector, access to good-paying local jobs is especially important from an equity perspective. According to a recent report from Clean Energy Economy Minnesota, our state currently has over 59,000 clean energy jobs, with thousands more in the broader utility industry across the state. That number is significant, but it's important to ensure that that tally includes an equitable and diverse representation of Minnesotans, including women, people of color, and veterans. Given the opportunity presented by this growing and ever-changing workforce, the ideas in House File 2218 are a good starting point to think about how we can align economic equity with energy decision-making. Fresh Energy believes that all Minnesotans should have access to family-sustaining jobs working in energy. We're happy to be helpful with further refining the proposed language as this conversation moves forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And do you have another testifier?
Yes, John Pacheco from the chamber, if he's here. Not seeing him? No, Madam Chair.
Well, then we have amendments, and we can look at the amendments right now. Is there someone who would like?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I may, just before we get through the amendments, amendments 1, 3, and 4 are on community solar gardens. I'm working on community solar garden legislation that I'm hoping we can hear next Thursday, and it seems like those amendments may be more appropriate to that underlying bill. I just wanted to suggest that perhaps those amendments be offered next week on the community solar bill.
Madam Chair,
Yes, my plan, sorry, excuse me, my throat's a little rough this morning. But yeah, my plan was really to just talk about these amendments. These are bills that have been moving forward. So the A1, the A2, the A3, and the A4 are bills that have been moving through the Senate as bills, and I think really encapture kind of a big important conversation that we need to have here in the House. You know, we're running short on time, and I believe that, you know, we need to start looking, you know, I'm concerned that we've got two different directions on where these bills are going from the House and Senate. I think we need to be looking at ways that we could be bringing the bills that are being created in the House and the Senate together. You know, the A1 amendment really talks about kind of on a solar garden perspective. You know, we've seen much larger from the conversation that I've had with stakeholders is the estimates on how large that could potentially have been and be has vastly outpaced where anyone's expectations were on that. And, you know, I think we do really need to look at how do we cap that and how, because we're affecting, it's one of the most expensive. So I think the only, probably the only place that you can find more expensive solar than the solar garden program in Minnesota potentially would be on the space station. And the A2 amendment kind of goes along the lines of kind of the caps on the payments so that we could kind of cap that and really help control the costs there. The A3 is also about solar gardens, and it includes some disclosure checklists for solar garden subscribers to kind of help for some better reporting and some better so we understand kind of exactly what's going on and making sure that we're doing what actually was probably talked about when that bill moved forward. And then the A4 amendment as well is some, definitely some more consumer protections. You know, we're very concerned about what's the potential with fraudsters going about. I know there's a few other bills moving forward in that particular area, but you know, I really think as a committee we should be looking at how do we bring this together so that maybe we can have some meaningful legislation pass and find some common ground. I think those amendments potentially, you know, I agree with Representative Long, we will have probably a longer conversation when those potential bills move forward, but I will not be offering those amendments. But I do have other questions potentially at some point, so during the hearing.
So I think the community solar is scheduled for Tuesday or Thursday.
My understanding is Thursday.
That Thursday, so that's when we will have that discussion.
Sounds great.
All right. Are there other folks who, first of all, are there questions for Representative Richardson? Representative Spasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill forward. You know, just kind of looking at the bill, I didn't notice any kind of requirements on the size of the utility that would have to comply with this. Some utilities are exceptionally small, don't necessarily have a large staff. Would you be at all interested if this bill was to move forward to kind of limit it so that small utilities would potentially be exempt from it, just from a reality of the staff standpoint and the rest?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. You know, we're just starting a conversation here, and I'm looking forward to working with utilities and Fresh Energy to really think about how we are able to move this forward. In a previous life, I've worked in programs that work with targeted businesses, small minority and women-owned businesses, and so I think that there are several models that are out there in terms of thinking about moving forward in terms of the reporting requirements, and also just the reality, you know, when there are less people who are working within a particular organization, that there just are not going to be as many opportunities for access to employment within those sectors. But thinking globally about how much we're contracting out and the hiring that's being done, I think it's an opportunity to ensure that we're moving towards a more diverse workforce.
Okay, so Madam Chair, so it sounds like, you know, this is not necessarily from a reporting standpoint, you're not looking at from a customer standpoint. You're looking at more of who the utility is doing business with. You know, are they that sort of thing? That's the end of that's your more goal with this than talking to customers?
Madam Chair's representative, so what we're really looking at is thinking about workforce opportunities. What are opportunities that are available for being hired within the sector, and also thinking about the requests for proposals or bids that might be going out as well, and thinking about the participation of targeted businesses and what their participation levels currently are, and whether there are opportunities for outreach in order to create more diversity, not only in terms of employment, but also contracting as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Richardson, I would just, you know, recommend, you know, if you just want to have a conversation about this, which it sounds like you're kind of starting that, you know, I would reach out to schools of higher education, to our trade schools, because if you're looking at employment, you're looking at employees, you're looking at who is, you know, having the chance to enter the sector for an mm-hmm. employment standpoint, that's probably your first, because if the folks aren't going and getting the degrees, regardless of the demographic, they're not going to have that foot in. So, you know, I think that's probably your, you know, rather than seeing what's there, you can't affect what's there until you actually are starting to affect your feeder line of potential employees. So, you know, have you looked at moving this forward in the higher ed portion before here?
Madam Chair, Representative, I actually am working with institutions of higher education. I've been successful in bringing federal funds to the state, and there's actually a cohort of youth right now between the ages of 12 and 17 that are getting access to early exposure to STEM careers. So that's something that I do in my other life as well. So I am taking those steps as well. And I think in terms of this bill, it's a both and. I think we need to know where we are in terms of what are we looking like from a workforce perspective and from a contracting perspective to know where the opportunities may be.
Madam Chair, Representative Richardson, just from a finance standpoint, obviously one of the complaints we always hear from departments and from utilities and schools and daycares is that we're asked to create a lot of accounts and a lot of data, and yet what is going to happen to that data? And, you know, if something happens to that data, it usually costs money. Is there a fiscal note attached to this at all, or is there, you see, what's your perceivable cost?
I think we can ask our fiscal analyst
sure.
that question.
Madam Chair, Representative Sudzinski. There is a fiscal note request out on 2218. I don't have a specific date about when we might get that, but I won't speculate as to the cost, but yes, the report is the main cost that this bill would have.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
I don't see other questions from members. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify? I don't see any others. Seeing no further discussion, House File 2218, I will renew my motion that it be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you for bringing it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next up. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 2233 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Long. I understand there is an author's amendment.
There is, Madam Chair. It just corrects an inconsistency that was spotted by counsel on the bill language.
And if you'd like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I move the A1 amendment.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted. Tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We know that the transportation sector is now the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. And with our current mix of electricity, electric vehicles are an outstanding way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Taking my own city, Minneapolis, as an example, electric vehicles using the mix of electricity in my city produce one-third as much carbon pollution as gasoline-driven vehicles, and that's only going to get better as we clean up our energy. In 2018, there were nearly 7,000 electric vehicle registrations total in the state, but we know this number is going to continue to grow. Energy forecasters anticipate electric vehicles will reach 54% of new car sales and a quarter of all cars on the road by 2040. But as with any new technology, there are still barriers to early adoption, and the biggest two for electric vehicles are price and anxiety about range. We address both in this bill. We provide a $2,500 rebate to new electric vehicle purchases and a $500 rebate to used electric vehicle purchases. This is a model that's been used successfully in a number of states around the country. We also establish a public charging grant program to expand our network of public charging stations. That's going to help with range anxiety and help folks feel like they can purchase an electric vehicle and know that they can get to the destinations that they want to around the state. Electric vehicle infrastructure, in addition to being good for greenhouse gas reductions, also good for jobs. The University of Minnesota study on this topic indicates that installing just 150 charging stations in greater Minnesota would generate $14 million in economic activity. We've also heard testimony in this committee that electric vehicles can level out electricity demand and improve grid utilization, so there are a number of benefits to this bill. I'd like to thank Representative Garofalo in absentia for his co-authorship of this bill. And with that, I will invite up my first testifier, Brendan Jordan with Drive Electric Minnesota.
Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Brendan Jordan with the Great Plains Institute, and I lead Drive Electric Minnesota. Drive Electric Minnesota is the state's electric vehicle partnership. For those of you, I'll just call your attention to a handout in your packets that lists our membership, and you can see that our membership is very broad, including nonprofit organizations, clean air organizations, automakers, auto dealers, the electric industry, and private charging companies, among others. Drive Electric wants to see increased electric vehicle adoption in the state, but we're not alone. In a survey conducted by FM3 in 2017, 68% of Democrats, 72% of independents, and 66% of Republicans say we should increase our use of electricity as a fuel. And 78 of people, including majorities of all political parties, support the use of incentives specifically to accomplish that goal. There is bipartisan support for this bill, and there's bipartisan support for this issue. Minnesota sales, EV sales today, are around the national average of about 1% of sales. The most leading states are approaching 10%, and that is because of public policy. House File 2233 includes two of the most impactful policies that have worked well in other states, incentives to support sales and investment in infrastructure. In fact, 34 states offer some kind of support, a range of public policies, including access to high occupancy vehicle lanes, direct incentives, sales tax incentives, exemptions, and other policies. And 14 states specifically offer rebates or tax credits to support sales. Now, why in the world should the state offer sales incentives for a specific type of vehicle? That's a good question. I think we have to answer that question. What I would say is that it's very common for the public to support emerging technologies. Minnesota has done this for a lot of technologies. The ethanol industry is one example. The idea here is temporary support. This is an emerging technology. The costs are a bit higher today. They are coming down rapidly. So what we support is a temporary incentive that does not need to exist once the costs come down and prices achieve parity. In terms of investment in infrastructure, it's really important that people be able to drive all over the state of Minnesota, not just in the metro area. And right now there is a chicken and egg issue. There is low utilization for chargers that get installed, which makes the economics challenging. Over time, you know, putting in infrastructure around the state will drive increased sales and will also drive the business model of operating those chargers. Members, I'd just like to call your attention one last thing. You have a color version of a map, and this shows statewide where EVs are showing up. And I think you'll see it's not just a metro phenomenon. Electric vehicles are showing up all over the state of Minnesota. The little blue lines are planned charging routes, charging corridors. You can see we're with a modest investment through Volkswagen settlement funding and other sources in the next couple of years, we'll reach a lot of the state, but not all of it. And many of those stations are sort of just one plug. It's sort of the minimum basic network. I think state support in this area will help bring EV charging to more parts of the state, and it's going to serve places where we are starting to see adoption all over the state. So, Madam Chair and members, I'll conclude my comments there, but I'm happy to take questions. I think this is a statewide opportunity.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to invite up my second testifier, Yuko Kukkonen, with Plug In Connect.
Good morning, Madam Chair, representatives. Thank you for having me here. My name is Yuko Kukkonen, and my company is Plug In Connect. I work as an EV market consultant here in Minnesota. In our family, we have driven electric for 7 years now and close to 100,000 miles. I also coordinate the Minnesota Plug-in Vehicle Owners Group, where we have over 1,500 members. So based on my wife's and our group members' experiences over the years, I can tell you that electric cars are great. Pretty much everyone who starts driving electric is never going back. It is just better car because it drives better, has better acceleration, heats up faster, is cheaper to own and drive, and doesn't pollute your garage or your neighborhood with tailpipe emissions. On societal level, EVs also drastically reduce the overall emissions, our reliance on imported oil, and it increases the beneficial utilization of electric grid. So they are win-win-win all around. I'll highlight two ways how SF2233 would help EV adoption in Minnesota. One of the biggest challenges with EV adoption in Minnesota is the low vehicle availability and related lack of marketing efforts. You have a list of plug-in vehicles that are sold here in Minnesota, and there are 40 models overall in the U.S. that are sold, but we only get 25 of those here in Minnesota. And even for these models that we get, very few units are allocated to our market. Right now, most of the auto manufacturers are treating Minnesota like a flyover country, but this bill with purchase rebate would send a strong message to the automakers. Minnesota wants increased sales of plug-in vehicles, so work with us. The other part that I want to highlight is the infrastructure side of things. If you look at the vehicle list, most of these vehicles are plug-in hybrids. With those, every morning the first miles are electric, and after that it switches to being hybrid, so there's no limitation. You can, if you want to drive to North Dakota, you can do it, but you're doing that then with the gas. But roughly a third of these models are full electric, and they don't have the gas backup. Earlier, most of those used to be under 100 miles, but now we are getting, now every one of those is over 150, closer to 200, some of them are over 200, and some over 300. So people are starting to use these cars for longer trips. But presently, you can only do that with Teslas because of their supercharging networks. Right now, for example, if you have a Chevrolet Volt or Nissan Leaf, those owners can drive to Moorhead. But with the charging infrastructure grants and this bill, those will help to develop better charging network on DC fast charging stations on highway corridors. So if Moorhead is your favorite destination, you can drive there also with your full electric car. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'd like to invite up Amber Backus with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus. I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs with the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association and here on behalf of its 373 franchise new car and truck members. And we are here to speak in support of House File 2233. Mr. Kukkonen alluded to, there are more plug-in models available than ever before, but the state's fleet overall of electric vehicles right now is about 0.2%. So a very small uptake so far, and as has been stated, a big deterrent to that is price, which this bill helps to address. Electric vehicle on average costs $10,000 to $15,000 more than its comparable conventional internal combustion engine vehicle. While consumer interest in these alternative powertrains is growing, a recent study by a Global Automotive and Deloitte shows that most consumers don't want to pay more for the technology. I think U.S. respondents who were interested didn't want to pay more than $300 to $2,000 more for electric vehicle technology. So this $2,500 rebate, along with federal tax credits, would get you to about $10,000 to offset that disparity. And as also has been said, states that have instituted tax credits or rebates, as this bill does, have seen sales of electric vehicles increase by 2 to 4 times the national average. This will help drive demand for the market, leading to lower vehicle costs and reducing that price disparity in the future. I looked at another study that showed for price-sensitive consumers, those that purchased a Nissan Leaf or a Chevy Bolt, 40% wouldn't have done so without the help of a tax credit. So it was instrumental in their decision to purchase that cleaner technology. The other thing we hope to accomplish with this bill is to have automotive manufacturers respond and get more vehicles into this market with a policy that helps promote them. As Yuka said, and I said, there are more EV models on the market than ever before, but that list he shared, I did a survey of our dealers and only found 14 of those models in stock right now. And oftentimes those are spoken for before they even get to the dealer's lot, which frustrates consumers who may be interested in purchasing those. So hopefully this policy would also drive the supply for Minnesota. And lastly, I just wanted to say that advancing EV deployment will have environmental benefits that can help reduce the potential for expensive federally mandated programs if Minnesota ever were to become a non-attainment area. EVs emit 65% less NOx, which contributes to ground levels of ozone than a comparable conventional internal combustion vehicle. And that's the category for which Minnesota is most at risk of exceeding the federal standards. This bill has the potential to curb NOx emissions by over 25,000 pounds. And I think, you know, the $15 million provided for EV rebates is far less than the cost of Minnesota becoming a non-attainment area, which would cost the business and community and consumers hundreds of millions of dollars annually. For example, the price of reformulated gasoline, which is often a response to becoming a non-attainment area, is currently 10 cents more a gallon than conventional gasoline in the Midwestern market. So I concur that the time is right for establishing an electric vehicle rebate program. Minnesota has the resources to make a short-term investment to provide long-term environmental and economic gains, and I would ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. And my final testifier is Matthew Blackler with ZEF Energy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matthew Blackler, CEO of ZEF Energy. We're an electric vehicle charging network operator and also an EV charger manufacturer with manufacturing in Montevideo, Minnesota. We've rolled out 30 DC fast chargers to date across Minnesota and Wisconsin. The funding for those chargers have come from multiple sources, OEMs, utilities, private entities. To make EVs more convenient, far more expensive fast chargers are required. The chargers that we've rolled out to date often cost about $60,000 or $70,000. The new, faster, more convenient chargers are sometimes 3 or 4 times that cost. One of the challenges is that, you know, currently utilization is low. And so the further out of state you get, the less utilization we see, and therefore it's very difficult to justify private investments. Public investment, such as that outlined in this bill, will provide equality of access to people within the state, and promote confidence to drivers to go electric because of the ubiquitous, convenient, fast charging access. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I do have one more individual who I just learned is interested in testifying. Chris.
If you could just, Representative Straczynski has a question.
Thank you. This is a question to the testifier. I forgot your name. It's Zibble.
Matthew Blackler from Zen Energy.
The person before. So you kind of talked about utilization and how it makes it non-cost effective for the charging system, so it's mostly public entities installing them. Kind of what would be the usage and percentage of prescription for them that would make them economic?
Typically, it would be about three or four charges a day. There's different ways of paying for charging. There's subscriptions. There's pay for usage. There's also OEM programs where an OEM might pay for the first 2 years of fast charging access. So there's multiple different ways of paying for charging it.
So, Madam Chair, say you put a, you make one that's at $60,000.
Yeah.
If you were to install one and want it to actually pay for the investment, you would need to get it three or four charges per day to pay
per
for
day.
That?
Yeah, per day.
So that would be, like, how long does the average charge take?
Currently, the average charge is about 35 minutes, but typically people don't always fill their battery all the way up. People typically just grab enough energy to get them to their destination. That will change with the faster chargers, and that will change as more people who live in multi-unit housing might rely on fast chargers more as their primary use of primary way of charging.
So, Madam Chair, so would the amount, what would be the amount of changes for a fast charger? You said those are like 230,000, 250,000. How many charges a day would those have to be to not need public support?
That would be 8 to 10 charges a day. One of the challenges is that there's the upfront capital, so it's the capital investment, but there's also the operational expenditure. So, you know, these charges, something goes wrong, it needs to be replaced, it needs to be maintained. There's certain operational costs of running these things. So one of the things that we're trying to focus on at the moment is making sure that we can cover the operational expenditure so these things stay maintained, we pay for the power bills, people can use them. But that's with the capital being covered up front.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, and so just to kind of the follow-up to that, so at the $60,000 charger, which you're familiar with, what would be your operational costs at a single fill-up? You know, for maintenance, you know, if I'm getting into the stuff that you can't share, that's fine. But, you know, are we, you know, looking at $1,000 a week? Are we looking at, you know, a month? You know, kind of, you know, rough estimate. And then from a maintenance standpoint, what percentage would that be? Like, do you see, is there a lot of parts that seem to go bad on those quickly? I mean, I'm really interested, so.
Yeah. I'd be happy to answer those questions afterwards.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there's one more testifier, correct?
Yes.
Maybe I could ask this after all the testimony is completed.
That'd be fine. We'll keep you on the list.
Yeah. And I'll be brief. My name is Chris Shane here. I represent Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. We're a wholesale energy provider to 18 municipal utilities across the state of Minnesota. Just as by way of definition of that, we've got members that are small as Preston and Blooming Prairie and cities that are as large as Owatonna and Rochester. They don't always agree on everything, but they do agree that we should be doing all that we can to deploy more electric vehicles across our economy. We've testified in the past that we believe in on our approach to climate change needs to be a multi-sector approach, and we believe this bill is a good step in that direction and an important step in that direction. SMPA's member municipal utilities are generally located in greater Minnesota. We appreciate the balanced approach that this bill takes towards providing incentives and building out the charging infrastructure, both in the metro area and in greater Minnesota. particularly in our member communities in greater Minnesota. Range anxiety is real and one of the major barriers to a greater adoption of electric vehicles. So we see this as a critical part of the component of our policy approach here in Minnesota to deploy more electric vehicles. We believe that the elements contained in this bill will complement the programs that SMPA and other power providers are developing on their own or already have in place. So we think it's a good comprehensive approach towards increasing the use of electric vehicles. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Representative Pornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks to all the testifiers. This is really tremendous information. Ms. Backus had pointed out that it's like 0.5% in terms of the, percentage of people that are owning electric vehicles. And I think Mr. Jordan had said that in other states, it's as high as 10%. So my question is, and I think your approach, Representative Long, is exactly what we need, sort of a combination of incentives and building out infrastructure. But maybe this is for Mr. Jordan. How long does it take typically, because we're pretty much starting from zero if you take into consideration what Ms. Backus had said, how long does it take to get from where we are to 10%? What was the timeline in these other states?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a great question. I'd have to look a little bit into that. I would expect with the establishment of an incentive program, you would see results immediately because there are a lot of there's a lot of collaboration already on marketing and promotion, and so what's lacking is that public policy push to kind of juice the market. In terms of how quickly we've seen results in other states, I would really have to look into that and get back to you.
Madam Chair, if I may, rebates do two things. One is they address the price issue for the consumer, but the second is they actually get vehicles here. And as Ms. Backus pointed out, there's a real shortage of actual availability of models for customers. So one of the reasons why the percentage is so low is that we just don't have that many vehicles that the auto manufacturers are bringing to the state.
Well, Madam Chair, it seems like, with the proper public policy, that's an excellent point. We could make a difference pretty quickly, and so I hope that this will be passed and signed into law, and we can finally get going. as has been pointed out many times, the fastest growing source of greenhouse gas emissions coming from the transportation sector, electric vehicles are a key part in reducing that. So this is a great bill, and I'm happy to support.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. Number one, to the author, or maybe the chair, where is this bill going? Will this be referred to transportation, perhaps, or where will this be going?
This is going to be laid over.
This will be laid over. Okay. Question maybe to the author, Representative Long. Maybe this is the testifier, or whoever wants to answer it. Sorry. I have some heartburn about offering rebates to vehicles, just period in general. I think we have limited dollars. I know some's coming from general fund, some's coming from RDA. And again, I think this could be looked at unfavorably from a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. But I understand some of the good outcomes, too. If there were no rebates in those 34 other states around the country, just putting us all right now on an even playing field, would we be looked at in Minnesota as viable due to our weather conditions? Because I've heard many times the batteries have issues with cold weather. So if somebody can answer that for me, just if everything was even, would we still be a considered state?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Baker. So I certainly understand the reluctance. I think that there are different ways to provide incentives for new technology. When we did it for ethanol, it wasn't directly to the consumers. It was sort of a back-end approach. I think directly to the consumers in this case makes the most sense since it's a consumer product that folks are purchasing. The federal rebate is substantial, and it's $7,500 at the moment. $8,000? Does it go up to?
No, $7,500.
And so when you combine the two, then this is really going to make a big difference in terms of making up the cost. So this is a federal policy that is nationwide, and then a number of states have implemented it as well. Maybe I'll Oh, and I wanted to point out one other thing, too, in the bill. We do try to make a nod to targeting vehicles towards those who really could use the rebate. So we have a cap on the price of the vehicle at $60,000. So you wouldn't be able to use it, for example, on a $100,000 or $80,000 BMW. You would only be able to use it on cars that are really sort of affordable for the average Minnesotan.
Madam Chair, Representative Wong, I think you missed the question, though. The question is, due to the cold weather, everything being even.
Oh, I was answering the first part of the question. Apologies. I'll let Mr. Kukkonen answer the second part.
Madam Chair, Representatives, so I will address that part of the thing. Right now, if you look at where the fastest growing EV market is right now, is Norway. There, over 60% of the vehicles sold, I'm sorry, over 50% of the vehicles sold last year were electric. So, and their weather conditions are not that far from what we see in Minnesota. So they will have had a really good incentives and good things in place, and people have just realized that this is just a great car, also for winter. So I don't think that the winter performance is really limiting in that way. We know that in a cold weather, battery electric vehicles will have a less of a range, but right now the range has increased so much that it used to be 73 miles, for example, Nissan Leaf 2012. With that one, yes, you will have challenges in the colder weather. Now you're talking about the new Plus coming out next month, over 200 miles. So it's less of an issue in that way. But other cold weather capabilities like faster heating and so forth actually will make it up and make it even better car in that way.
Thank you. And just a final question, Madam Chair. There's some real winners in this bill if it passed. Again, I see dealers winning. They're selling more cars, more probably a little more expensive cars. There's power companies. Co-ops, munis will win. They'll sell maybe some more energy, some more power. Because of there's some winners in here. Have you, Representative Long, talked to some of those folks about how they may contribute to this program as well? Maybe have you entertained the thought of asking or having this part of the SIP program where they could get credits for this kind of a thing to encourage local municipals or utilities, co-ops, to kind of engage in this too, but to help this program multiply better without a complete ask from either XL ratepayers or general fund, general taxpayers? Just a thought on that SIP ask.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Baker. It's a very good idea, and it is actually contained in the bill I authored on Tuesday. The governor's proposal includes the ability to have electric vehicle programs count through SIP. So I think that's a good idea. I think they're complementary.
Thank you.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, one of the areas I was looking at in the bill on line 221 and 222 talks about the MSRP. So let's say I go to a place and I'd like to qualify for the rebate. The car is used, but the MSRP is above $60,000.
So your question, Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, so your question is, would it count for the $500 rebate if it was used in over $60,000?
Yeah, let's say it was valued on the lot at $20,000.
So if it was $20,000, then it would not exceed the $60,000 limit, so then you would be able to qualify for the rebate.
So I wouldn't be able to buy it, even though it was $20,000 in the lot?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, I'm not quite sure what your question is. If you're able to buy any car you'd like, if your question is, does a rebate apply, the rebate is kicked out if the retail price is over $60,000. If it is under $60,000, then you're able to use the rebate.
Is that? So even if the vehicle is used and it has an original MSRP value of $60,000, it's valued at $20,000, I would not be able to buy it under this program.
Madam Chair and Representative Swazinski, I'll chime in here. Because the threshold is the MSRP, if it were used and the purchase price were less, it still wouldn't qualify because it's based on that initial MSRP the first year. If we need to fix that to accommodate the used vehicle market, we could probably figure out a way to do that. But I think the intent of the bill was at least with new vehicle purchases, not to be subsidizing new purchase of luxury vehicles, but to make it more accessible for average Minnesotans.
Okay. And then just another, you know, kind of looking at, I think what that portion of the bill is getting at is you don't want to be buying luxury vehicles, you know, essentially subsidizing people's egos kind of with a fancy car. You know, is there any thought, you know, we talked just with the bill prior that Representative Richardson talked about the demographic and who's participating in these programs to have this be a progressive? So look at actual people's income, whether or not that they could qualify for these programs?
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, it's a good question. It was not something that I thought made the most sense in this context. I think that getting at the price of the vehicle, I thought, was the best way to try to limit the purchases from folks who could already afford the more expensive models.
So, Madam Chair, you think they could already afford that, the more expensive model?
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, I'm saying if you're wealthy, you are going to be able to afford a more expensive model. If you're less wealthy, you're going to be able to afford less expensive models.
So, I mean, so this seems interesting, you know, just from, you know, from a regressive tax point, you know, we're looking to raise taxes on gasoline. We're looking to raise, and then we're trying to subsidize that through earned income tax credits in the tax bill. And then a bill like this, which, you know, well, we kind of have a cap number at 60,000, but we don't want to focus it on folks that maybe don't have access to a vehicle like this. And then another question would be kind of along to the dealers. You know, we're kind of concerned about charging stations and the amount of access they have to actually fill up. Is there any thought to, you know, kind of as a participation, they talked a little bit about trying to incentivize maybe some private push towards this. Would there be any incentive to, you know, in order for a vehicle to qualify in someone's lot, that they actually have to have a dealer charging station on that location?
Certainly.
So like in order to be able to offer that credit from the state, that you also have to have built a place that you could actually fill it up?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, actually our dealers that sell electric vehicles are required by their manufacturer to have a charging station on their lot. So they have been making significant investments. I've heard some of our dealers gripe about it, to put in a charging station of $20,000 to $40,000 to do so, but they would automatically have to have one because when they're servicing those vehicles and they come in, they need to be able to provide that and for consumers to have a test drive. Just to your early question, too, about a means test for income, in the past, the Drive Electric Coalition had considered that, but we thought that would be tougher to administer and that would divert more funds to actually figuring out whether people qualify, whereas the MSRP is an easier way to figure out a sort of bright line for who's in or who's out. And just with trends, most people with higher incomes will tend to buy higher vehicles. Again, as I referenced earlier, you know, this is really to deal with consumers who are price sensitive, and that $10,000 difference will make a difference whether they purchase EV or a conventional vehicle.
And Madam Chair, just to that point, you know, I've read articles. You know, we're talking $10,000 because of $7,500 credit at the federal level, or the proposed $2,500 at the state. I've heard reports that there are even more than that, so there's other kind of incentives that are maybe hidden behind that to the point that it would be, let's say, about a $45,000 car, the actual financial impact on the person buying it would be dramatically less than that, less than 35, would be down to 25 or 20. I've just read a couple, I don't know if there's some more things kind of hidden behind the weeds that aren't talking about right now, but.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, I'm not familiar with those. Maybe Mr. Jordan could weigh in there, but.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, you know, what that might refer to would be discounting by the manufacturer, but that's really up to them as a manufacturer if they want to offer a discount to, and manufacturers offer discounts at times on all types of vehicles. But that is something that does occur sometimes in the electric vehicle sector that can impact that price point.
Final question?
Sure, if you'd like it to be, Madam Chair. You know, so that would be just from a manufacturer standpoint. I think there are programs that incentivize manufacturers to offer those. So taxpayer money is going to the manufacturers to drive down the cost, and then there's none of that going on?
Okay.
All right. I'll take that no as a no.
I see one more question from Representative Bowe. I would remind committee members that we have two more bills up. We have reserved a room for tonight. We can go this evening or we can finish up the bills this morning. Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. They were going to be quick. They'll be even quicker now. So regarding the charging stations, question number one is trying to wrap my head around what's considered to be a public location. Are we talking shopping centers, government centers, or are we talking apartment buildings where people who live there would use them but not many others? Or
thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, we don't define public. I would take it as common usage that it has to be something that is generally accessible to the public.
Okay. Thank you. And second question, would a grant recipient be able to charge, pardon the pun, for the ability to charge at that facility? In other words, can they charge a fee to collect to cover their costs for the energy? I don't see that addressed one way or another here.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, they would be able to charge for the use of charging. Or at least there's no language in here that prevents them from doing so.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any further discussion. Representative Long renews his motion that House File 2233, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you to testifiers. Representative Long is now going to move that 2369 be laid over.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my motion.
Oh. It's 96. I'm sorry.
2396. Sorry. Next. Madam Chair, I have an author's amendment to this bill as well. And I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Long. Do you have an author's amendment here?
Yes, I just moved it, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention to where my all my stuff is. All those in favor of the author's amendment say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Buildings account for 40% of overall Minnesota energy consumption. And this bill is an affordable solution to help us reduce energy consumption and save money. Many cities across the state have set sustainability goals or are looking for ways to reduce energy consumption, and this bill establishes a voluntary stretch building code that cities could adopt to help meet those goals. The code cities would be allowed to adopt is Sustainable Building 2030, otherwise known as SB 2030. SB 2030 was initiated by the Minnesota Legislature in 2008. It was designed specific to Minnesota by the Center for Sustainable Building Design at the University of Minnesota. SB 2030 buildings are cheaper to operate, and efficiency improvements are required to meet a cost-effectiveness test. SB 2030 has been required for all projects that receive general obligation bond funding from Minnesota for nearly a decade. It is familiar to the Minnesota design and construction industries. Over 150 commercial projects representing about 12.5 million square feet in Minnesota have already met the SB 2030 standard. These include office buildings, multifamily housing, retail, and recreation. Over 120 engineering, architecture, and energy modeling firms have direct experience with SB 2030. This bill does not require any city to act. It also avoids patchwork building codes because it is using a known, proven code that already exists and has been saving consumers and taxpayers money for a decade. It is limited to buildings of a minimum of 10,000 square feet, and cities can set higher limits if they are more appropriate to their community. This bill has broad support across the state, including the cities of Duluth, Falcon Heights, Eden Prairie, Edina, Golden Valley, Grand Marais, Maplewood, Minneapolis, Morris, Rochester, St. Louis Park, and St. Paul. The League of Minnesota Cities also supports the option of a stretch code, and municipalities in multiple other states offer their local jurisdictions a stretch code option. In your packets, you have letters of support, I hope, from the City of St. Louis Park, from the City of Rochester, who was hoping to be here but couldn't testify in person, from the City of Minneapolis. And I don't know if this made it in your packet, but there's also a unanimously approved resolution from the Morris City Council as well. Last thing I'll note is that in 2016, the state did a study called the Climate Solutions and Economic Opportunities Report, looking at different approaches to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. They found implementation of a stretch building code to be a key priority in meeting the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals. In fact, it ranked stretch codes the number one most job-producing solution and the second most cost-effective solution. I also want to thank Representative Bowe for co-authoring this bill with me. I think this makes sense for our climate and for saving money. And with that, I would like to invite up my testifiers, Russell Stark, who's the Chief Resilience Officer for the City of St. Paul. I'd like to call him up first. Maybe we'll invite Robert Ellis to come up as well for time's sake.
Yes, it would be good if the other testifiers could go up with him.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. Russ Stark, Chief Resilience Officer in the City of St. Paul and Mayor Carter's office. Glad to be here this morning. St. Paul has more experience than most communities with the idea of a stretch building code and SB 2030, in that for almost 10 years we've had a sustainable building policy that applies to any building receiving public funds of $200,000 or more of any kind. So anything from state bonds to city dollars to pass-through funds from the Met Council. So we've had 60 buildings of those 150 statewide, actually a little more than 60, come through our program since 2010 successfully. Everything from CHS Field to the Palace Theater multifamily housing projects such as Hamlin Station at Hamlin and University Avenues in St. Paul. We are excited at the prospect of getting new tools for accelerating our work in energy efficiency and clean energy and reducing our emissions. As a city, we have set goals of being carbon neutral in our city buildings by 2030 and in all buildings across St. Paul by 2050. And a stretch code is exactly the type of tool that we're going to need to ultimately achieve those goals, particularly the community-wide goals. We urge your support to give us this tool that will help us accelerate on our goals, and I think help continue to show the way that we can make a lot of progress more quickly than we might think. Obviously, ultimately, in order to reduce emissions in the building used in energy used in buildings, we're going to have to work on all buildings, existing buildings, new construction, et cetera. But there's this great opportunity to really set the standard, particularly in new construction and major rehab, as an important first step along those lines. So I thank you for your consideration, and the City of St. Paul strongly supports this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Ellis, Public Works Director for the City of Eden Prairie. And I'm present here today on behalf of the city to show support for House File 2396. I'll share that the proposed bill aligns with energy goals established by the city through our Energy Action Plan. This action plan calls for a significant reduction in commercial building energy use and the associated greenhouse gas emissions in the near-term future. We found that changes in habits can positively impact energy usage, but we've also found that it's not enough, and the improved building energy performance is necessary and critical if we're to achieve these goals. This will require a more robust energy standard, and the energy standards already in place through Sustainable Buildings 2030 would be an excellent place to start. These standards have been employed in over 12.5 million square feet of building space in Minnesota. Building owners, design engineers, architects, contractors, all have experience with SB 2030, and they've demonstrated these standards are cost effective. By adopting this bill, cities have the option of implementing SB 2030 standards on buildings of 10,000 square feet or larger. This would enable cities like Eden Prairie the ability to more realistically meet energy and greenhouse gas reduction goals. It would also ensure that buildings constructed today will be viable in the future as energy costs rise and businesses factor in the environmental footprint they leave in choosing where to locate. This will keep buildings built today sustainable well into the future. Eden Prairie, alongside our many other partners that are working on this bill, thank the committee for its forward thinking and encourage the passage of House File 2396. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have two additional testifiers I'd like to invite up, Richard Graves and Eric West. Maybe they could both come up.
Yes, we have also other folks who signed up to testify, so if we can keep our testimony right on point.
Madam Chair, representatives, I'm Richard Graves, the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota. In 2008, the Minnesota Sustainable Building 2030 standards were enacted by the legislature and designated the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the university to lead the development of the standard. It was based upon the National Architecture 2030 standard, which set a goal to have ever more increasing energy efficiency standards marching towards net zero energy buildings by 2030. Within the program, we try to define and work on energy efficiency that's cost effective for state-funded building projects. A 2009 study that we conducted with our partners in the program, reviewing 115 buildings in the region, determined that cost-effective strategies were strategies within a 15-year payback. So an additional, for whatever additional cost was required to do the strategy in a building, if it paid back within 15 years, that was determined as cost-effective, balancing benefits to the owner and benefits to society. To date, we've had over 160 building projects go through the program. 152 of those, or 92%, have met our standard. And on average, those projects are saving 34% over a typical building in 2003. When you compare those buildings to meeting just the minimum energy code, they are saving approximately $4.8 million per year. And when you factor in the projects that we're working on in design and the future savings we'll have in that cohort, they'll save $29.1 million per year. Example projects that within that 160, it's really a wide range of projects that get state funding, everything from small camper cabins at a state park to large classroom buildings on Minnesota state campuses. A couple of example projects, the Department of Natural Resources Glenwood Area Office Facility, which is about a 6,800 square foot facility. It has an annual savings over code of about $5,600 and is saving 20 tons of carbon per year. The City of Mankato Transit Facility, about 43,600 square feet in Mankato, has an annual savings of about 49,000 per year and 311 tons of carbon. So, you know, the important thing to understand about SB 2030 is it's a performance-based code. It's a percent reduction over a typical building in 2003, and it ramps up over time, where currently we're doing 70% better buildings than a 2003 building, and January 1st, 2010, we'll be doing 80% better buildings until we reach 90% better buildings in 2025 and beyond. So thank you very much.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Eric West. I'm an architect and current president of the American Institute of Architects in Minnesota, or AIA Minnesota. We represent about 2,300 architects across the state of Minnesota. And AIA Minnesota supports HF 2396, and we thank Representative Long for bringing this proposal forward. We support legislative efforts toward a more sustainable built environment in Minnesota, and we are in favor of giving municipalities the ability to apply the well-established 2030 standards. We see this legislation as a key part of the city's ability to create a sustainable and more resilient future. We hope every city will actually adopt the 2030 standards, the right thing for Minnesota's future, and because broad acceptance will make compliance even easier for architects, builders, cities, building officials, and building owners. Architects have been working with the 2030 standard for years, as stated by other testifiers. It was developed by a broad range of experts in the field and practice, and it's well established. Expanding the scope will reduce Minnesota's carbon footprint and make compliance a standard of practice across the state. Sustainable building practices will also create jobs and increase value of real estate assets. At the national level, our organization has conducted studies on the impact of similar legislation. And in Philadelphia alone, 77% of the city buildings need energy retrofits, supporting the creation of more than 23,000 jobs, while reducing the environmental impact of those buildings for years to come. We recognize that we need to look at all avenues when building a comprehensive plan to climate change, and wanted to point out that nearly 40% of all greenhouse gas emissions are produced by buildings. And while we've made great strides to improve energy efficiency in buildings, there's still a great deal that can be done. And this legislation will help address a better built environment and a better Minnesota. And we thank you for your efforts.
Representative Spasinski, and then we'll have four public testifiers, if you can be ready to come up.
We can get them.
You want public testifiers first?
Yes.
All right. Scott McKellen, and then Remy Stone, and please be cognizant of the fact that we could might need to come back here tonight if this goes on too long.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Scott McClellan. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Department of Labor and Industry and also the state building official from Minnesota. Although the department strongly supports broader efforts to increase energy efficiency statewide in buildings, we have two concerns with the bill that would preclude us from supporting it in its current form. I'll be extremely brief. First, the policy and purpose of the state building code is established in 326B101 requires our code to be basic, uniform, and tend to lower construction costs. However, under the bill, number one, municipalities would have the option of adopting these differing energy provisions. Therefore, they would no longer be considered uniform with one another. And number two, as the standards go beyond the current energy code, they would not be considered basic or tend to lower construction costs. Our second concern is that SB 2030 is not a code. It is a very sophisticated and customized design and verification process that requires the participation of building scientists, the U of M software, and design engineers. So without special training and allowances that extend after building occupancy, this type of design standard cannot be conventionally evaluated and enforced by local building officials. Having said this, the department does stand ready to work with the author to develop alternative language that might help achieve the goals of the bill. Thank you.
Remy Stone, and then Nick Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Remy Stone. I represent the Builders Association of Minnesota. We're a residential trade organization representing about 2,000 companies statewide. We concur with a lot of what Mr. McClellan just provided. I do want to stress with you a couple of things. One, the Minnesota State Building Code is the construction standard throughout all of Minnesota. It's something that our members are required to build toward. Although it's not enforceable by municipalities unless they adopt it by local ordinance, it creates the level playing field for the construction industry. So we need to build to it whether or not a local government adopts ordinance enforcing the code. And because it is a state building code, it provides uniformity and a level playing field for all of our members. As a matter of policy, Madam Chair and members, BAM consistently supports the adoption and enforcement of a uniform statewide code, adopted and enforced uniformly throughout the state, and we oppose efforts to fragment the code. A stretch code, regardless of its application, allows local governments to deviate from a uniform code and creates a patchwork of regulations across the state. This bill establishes a precedent for future statutory authority to allow cities to pick and choose what construction codes they will enforce, and this is something that is untenable for our industry. In addition, this initiative ignores the very, very low-hanging fruit of making sure the current energy code is enforced statewide, an effort that could result in dramatic compliance with existing code and would translate into statewide energy savings. And in a different day, I would like to show you my picture of how poorly the code is enforced statewide. Thank you.
Nick Erickson, and then Todd Lindquist.
My name is Nick Erickson. Thank you, members of the committee, for having us here today. You know, one thing we didn't hear throughout most of the testimony until Mr. McClellan came up is affordability. Minnesota is in the middle of a housing affordability crisis. I spend my days testifying about this here at the Capitol. We've been in front of committees in both chambers talking about the need for more affordable housing. Fortunately, this bill takes us in the wrong direction. Minnesota is the most energy efficient state for new construction of any high growth state. In fact, our organization, Housing First Minnesota, runs Minnesota's largest green energy and energy efficient construction program. Since its inception, we've independently rated and tested more than 16,000 homes for energy efficiency. And 50 years ago, as you heard from Mr. McClellan, the legislature had the wisdom to set a uniform building code and standards for the state, something that we think needs to be retained. It's also important to note that this legislation adversely impacts this multifamily, townhome, twin home production most significantly, and those are the homes that are at the lowest, most affordable price point for our buyers. So as you're considering this legislation, please keep housing affordability in mind. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Todd Lilgenquist, Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We are the trade association for owners, managers, and developers of rental housing in the state. I want to thank Representative Long for the conversation we had on the bill yesterday. Our organization has two primary concerns on the bill, and one, actually both have been highlighted, so I'll try and be brief. Mr. McClellan pointed out the uniformity of the statewide building code, and that's something that we see as very important and preventing differing jurisdictions from having different standards. The other concern I want to highlight is, as Mr. Erickson highlighted, is the affordability component on construction of multifamily properties. Our concern is that additional construction costs may make it more difficult to secure financing from lending institutions and from private investment. Financing for multifamily construction is already difficult, and any additional barriers may prevent a project from actually moving forward. As we all know, housing affordability is a critical issue, and increased construction costs will not help in meeting our imperative need of producing more housing units. Could actually result in increased rents in order to make the construction project financially feasible. I thank you for your time, and we're willing to have further conversations with Representative Long.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski, you had a question.
Madam Chair, are we done with the public testimony?
I think so, yes. Was there any other public testimony? I don't think so.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a couple questions I had. So could independent, so under the current code, maybe we could talk to the deed folks, the folks that kind of handle the, not deed, but any, Dolly, sorry. Could independent businesses request through their architect to kind of upgrade their code or their building sectors? So we don't necessarily have to have a government to do it, but if we have an individual business or family or farm, I mean, could they potentially do this on their own?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, if I'm understanding your question correctly, I think you're asking could a building be built above code? And
yes,
it can be.
So anyone that wants this can already have this?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, no. Cities are very interested in having the ability to have stretch codes in their city, as I named 12 that were interested in this. And right now, those cities are precluded from offering within their cities the option of having higher energy efficiency codes.
I should restate my question, Madam Chair, Representative Long. So I'm just saying anyone that actually wanted to build a building like this can do this.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, yes, but I'll illustrate one point. So I've heard from several cities who've said that they are having a once-in-a-two-decade building being built in their city, and they really would like it to be more energy efficient. And they'll have a conversation with the building developer and say, please, would you consider having this be more energy efficient? The developer will say, we we appreciate your request, but no. So there's no real ability for there to be a conversation with the city and the developers about the types of energy efficiency that are happening in those cities.
Okay. And then, you know, let's say this got into place and the cities were able to, Madam Chair, sorry, I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I know what I'm supposed to do. So let's say this moved forward and each of these cities, Duluth and Morris and Minneapolis, were able to implement this. What do you would suspect would be the amount of energy saved in the state in total?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I couldn't answer that specifically to your question about these specific cities, but I would mention that the report that was done by the state, the Climate Solutions and Economic Opportunities Report, did find that this would be the second most cost-effective climate solution, and they ranked this very high in their list of ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Madam Chair? So let's say that this bill didn't move forward. Would you be interested? So let's say you've got a building being built in a particular city, and the local utility under current SIP requirements would say, dear company or dear business being built, would you the utility be able to count SIP to the energy saved by implementing a different type of code?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, good question. The answer is yes. We address that on lines 3.20 to 3.21.
Sounds good. I agree with the testifiers just in general on this bill that, you know, I really am very concerned about, you know, having a patchwork, and I think having a uniform code across the state in this particular area is a good thing, and I think we should keep it and not make
things work. Representative Mecklen has the last question.
Do you have, Madam Chair, Representative Long, do you have an idea what, in the realm of multi-housing, what this could potentially cost, add to the additional cost of each unit?
Madam Chair, Representative Mecklen, so my understanding is that the overall cost is in the range of 1% in terms of the total construction costs that are increased for meeting this. But as one of our testifiers mentioned, there is a 15-year payback on in terms of the return on investment for the efficiencies. So the operating costs are cheaper. There may be a slightly increased cost in terms of building.
Madam Chair, I'm more concerned on the residential side. If we have a lack of affordable housing currently going on, how would that young potential new family or new buyer have the ability to come up with 1%? And on top of that, where we have a problem, as I think one of the people testified, these new construction projects are not even coming, they're not being valued as high as what it costs to actually produce them, which this would then further drive that cost up.
Madam Chair, Representative Mecklen, so the residents of the buildings would actually be seeing the benefits of the higher energy efficiency because they're usually the ones who are paying the electric bill. So I think for the low-income residents, there is going to be a reduced impact for them. I do take the concern seriously about increased costs for affordable housing. I think that's a real issue, but I think that cities are in the best position to make that decision and balance the affordable housing needs and their environmental needs and try to figure out a way to see if there's a possibility of addressing this real small increase in cost for what we see as really large benefits for greenhouse gas emissions and for energy efficiency.
Madam Chair, one more. You said they would experience the savings, if you will. But not if they can't afford to get in there to begin with, how are they going to experience the savings?
Madam Chair, Representative Mecklen, I conceded that there is a legitimate concern with making sure that you're having affordable housing built. And I think the 12 cities that support this all have very robust affordable housing programs as well, but they still view this as a really important way forward. And I think that they view this as striking the right balance.
Okay. With that, I see no further discussion, and Representative Long renews his motion that Asphalt 2396 be laid over for possible inclusion, and it is laid over.
Fiscal note on this at all?
Is there a fiscal note on this?
Madam Chair, Representatives, currently there's not a fiscal note with the amended language from today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
House File 2396 has been laid over. Representative Mahoney is not here, but if we heard that bill, and if Representative Long would be so kind as to be a substitute, then we could get this bill done and not come back tonight, or we can choose to come back tonight.
Madam Chair, I had a real honest question here. I was looking at, I should have talked about this earlier, but on House File 2233, I know we laid that over for possible inclusion, but I was looking at 3.19 through 3.23, where the appropriation is going to the Commissioner of Commerce, and I know we have the Commissioner of the Commerce Committee here, and I think, you know, because it is an expenditure and we're asking the department to do something in that particular area and expenditure potentially a new program, you know, I kind of think this bill probably needs to make a gander over to that direction.
Actually, we do have part of commerce in our jurisdiction, so we would make sure it went to the part of commerce in our jurisdiction. So
is that we're not going to hear it in the Commerce Committee? You don't think?
I don't think we need to, unless.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and Representative Swazinski, if it's an appropriation, that appropriation is under the jurisdiction of this committee. It's not the policy.
All right. With that, I am sensing that folks would like to go ahead and do House File 2269. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't planning on doing three bills a day, so I'll try to be very brief. So,
Madam Chair, we're fine coming back tonight. It's fine.
So we'll proceed per your request, Madam Chair. So the St. Paul Biomass Cogeneration Plant was originally sited at District Energy to help the region deal with significant wood waste issues, and Minnesota is currently facing an urgent situation with wood waste. I will, for the sake of time, defer to our testifier to talk about the bill.
And then we will make sure that I believe Mr. Evans is also on the schedule to testify. We'll make sure he's heard too. Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Ken Smith. I'm the President and CEO of Evergreen Energy and District Energy St. Paul. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about House File 2269. Since 2003, our affiliate, St. Paul Cogeneration, has been supplying renewable electricity to Xcel to fulfill a portion of the biomass mandate, while also supplying low-carbon heat to the buildings in downtown St. Paul. The integration of St. Paul Cogeneration into a modern district energy system also resulted in significant fossil fuel use reduction and also carbon reduction of over 100,000 tons. One of the key reasons for siting a new biomass facility at District Energy in the 90s was the region was struggling with managing significant volumes of tree waste from diseased trees, storms, et cetera. And St. Paul Cogeneration was purposefully designed to utilize this waste streams as a renewable fuel to help solve the problem. As our current PPA agreement nears its conclusion in 2023, we are asking the legislature for certainty in regards to the plant's operation in light of the important public purpose it serves as a key outlet for waste wood in this region. Today, approximately 260,000 tons of biomass fuel is used annually to generate 153,000 megawatt hours of electricity. Over the past 5 years, we've helped over 115 communities and 22 counties manage their wood waste streams. And as emerald ash borer has spread, we have seen an increase in that. In the past year, approximately 50% of the urban wood waste that we utilized was made up of either EAB contaminated wood waste or was the result of a EAB management program. We agree the system in place is not perfect. While St. Paul Cogeneration serves a public purpose by turning large quantities of wood waste into energy source, the cost of processing and transporting the waste wood to generate electricity does pass through to Xcel's customers. It is why we are actively working with stakeholders an option to reduce the burden on Xcel's customers and is supporting additional legislative efforts this year to allocate additional state resources towards defraying these costs. And we are imposing a rate restriction in our proposal today. Minnesota has learned that electricity from biomass has proven to be expensive compared to other renewables, such as wind and increasingly utility-grade solar. However, some perspective on the impact of this particular facility is in order. Based upon the annual report that Xcel submitted to Commerce last summer in 2017, Xcel NSP Minnesota
generated and purchased over 48 million megawatt hours of electricity. By contract, St. Paul Cogen is limited to producing 153,300 megawatts per year. In other words, 99.7% of the electricity in Minnesota for Xcel comes from generating sources other than St. Paul Cogeneration. While this plant is a very small part of Xcel's generation, it plays an enormous role in dealing with wood waste in this region. Since 2003, we have processed and used over 3.7 million tons of biomass. It is clear that Minnesota needs significant infrastructure to manage its waste streams as statewide problem is continuing to grow with the spread of EAB. And to that point, MPCA, DNR, and Metro counties, including a letter from Commissioner Reinhart, which is, should have been forwarded to you today, have testified to the importance of St. Paul Cogeneration as a management tool in this region. Without a viable alternative, local units of government will have to find other ways to manage their current wood waste streams, plus the additional EAB contaminated tree waste as it continues to spread across Minnesota. This facility may not be a permanent solution, but it provides a valuable bridge for this region until a longer-term alternative is available. Extending the operation of this facility to 2030 is a modest extension, provides planning and operational certainty needed to manage the region's wood waste while state and other stakeholders determine the best path forward and how to pay for it. Thank you.
Thank you. I would just note for the record, there is an amendment here, but if we were to adopt the amendment, the bill would have to be referred to environment policy. So I'm going to suggest we do not do that so we can lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Rick Evans?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on today's legislation, House File Number 2269. Xcel Energy currently has a contract with District Energy to purchase the electricity that they provide. It is the most or perhaps second most expensive energy that we buy on our entire system. It is also the dirtiest or close to the dirtiest energy that we produce and buy on our system. Its carbon emissions are far above Xcel Energy's fleet average for carbon emissions. Sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxide, which contribute to acid rain and respiratory problems, is far in excess of Xcel Energy's fleet average. And as we discussed the other day in another bill, it requires thousands of miles of truck traffic every single day to deliver this energy from all across the state to the site in St. Paul. The current contract runs through the end of 2023, so just a little under 5 years remain on the current contract. Xcel Energy and District Energy have had discussions about the possibility of extending the contract. If we were to conclude those discussions, we would have to take it to the Public Utilities Commission, which would review the contract in detail, have public hearings, have public input on the contract, and then decide whether the contract was in the best interest of our customers. Apparently, District Energy has decided they don't want to negotiate a new contract. They want to come here and have you force us to enter a new contract. And not only to enter into a new contract, but to force us to reform our current contract. It's been 30-some years since I went to law school and studied constitutional law. But I think the contract clause of the U.S. Constitution might say something about whether the legislature ought to be telling Xcel Energy that it has to reform a contract it currently has with another private business. This is an unprecedented, as maybe a little hyperbole, but this is an unprecedented step in the state of Minnesota where the legislature is being asked to force two private companies to enter into a contract and to reform an existing contract. And if you look at line 2.16, to require the Public Utilities Commission to approve it, to find it in the public interest, to find it reasonable. Let's take a look at this a little bit. Look at lines 2.9 and 2.13. Though the price of the contract is being dictated in the legislation, all the other terms are open to negotiation between Xcel Energy and District Energy. And yet, in line 2.16, the PUC will have nothing to say about those terms. two private parties will be able to enter into a contract, the terms of that contract, it'll go to the Public Utilities Commission, and they have one choice, to approve it, to find it reasonable, regardless of what it says, to find it in the public interest, regardless of what it says. Xcel Energy does not want any part of that kind of an operation. We go to the Public Utilities Commission to have our energy acquisitions approved by them on all of the terms. You're being asked to approve a contract, and you have no idea what the terms are. As we've talked about in this committee, the direction of the state is reducing carbon. As you know from my company's point of view, the direction is reducing carbon. Extending this contract by an additional 7 years beyond the next five so that it can continue to emit carbon dioxide is exactly the opposite direction. Yes, they make very efficient use of their energy. There's no question about that. But you know what? Our Sherco plant sells steam to a local customer that uses it in their process. Our King plant sells steam to a customer that uses it in their process. We're trying to be very efficient. Those are two coal plants. Would this committee consider if we came in and said, gee, we think we ought to extend the life of those contracts even beyond what we're currently going to do because, golly, look how efficient they are. And that's not even looking at the low price, which is the next thing I'd like to mention. You look at line 2.7. You're being asked to dictate the price of the energy that will come out of this contract. The price isn't stated there very explicitly, so you don't know what you're approving. But you're going to be approving the price of energy in a contract and then telling the Public Utilities Commission they have to find it reasonable. What's the basis for that price? What's the analysis? How is it arrived at? What's the fairness to our customers? What's the fairness to anybody? You're being asked to take it on faith. There'll be no review of this price because the Public Utilities Commission is ordered to take it. I know I'm running out of time, Madam Chair, and I'm going to finish as quickly as I can. Two more things I'll say. First of all, as the bill itself acknowledges, the DNR is currently undertaking a study of how to deal with the emerald ash borer wood. And yet what you're being told here today is to pass a bill and extend this contract 12 years into the future. It seems like we already have the answer, and the DNR is only starting to ask the question. That's not the way this should be done. And finally, I will say, as the bill acknowledges, the emerald ash borer is a statewide problem. If the state wants to deal with it, the state should deal with it. It should be done through general funds, in our opinion. But if you want to do it through energy funds, it's not Xcel Energy customers' problem. It's a state problem. District Energy can sell energy to any utility in the state or to every utility in the state. And if that's the way you want to pay for this problem, then that's where the energy should be sold. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, we had a group called CUB that talked about advocating for utility rates. Are they happening to be in the crowd?
Nobody signed up to testify.
Okay. You know, I think that's, you know, these are, you know, that's one question I'd like to know. I've heard, Madam Chair, members, I've heard estimates that the utility rate is this 20 cents? Is this 25 cents? I mean, I've heard kind of a wide range that, you know, from an expense standpoint, that this is some of the most expensive energy. Kind of, do we have an idea where this is at? I mean, I've heard a lot of hyperbole, a lot of, what is the current cost? What is currently being paid by ratepayers for this?
Madam Chair,
this will be the last question.
Member, that is a trade secret. However, it is in the range of the biomass has been in the higher range, and it's comparable to community solar gardens.
So, very expensive, Madam Chair. You did, I mean, to be fair, you did say we had this room reserved for tonight, and I think this is a pretty, this is an important bill. I mean, we're talking about Constitution. We're talking about breaking contracts in this bill. I mean, this is not a simple bill. You know, I've got my A1 amendment, I actually think is pretty common sense in the fact that, in a lot of different areas, the reason why we feel this needs to exist, to begin with, one of the arguments is being made, is that it helps dispose of wood products because of emerald ash borer, which is an invasive species. It's not an aquatic one. It's one that's in the air among the rest of us. Yet we spend money out of the Outdoor Heritage Fund to pressure wash boats, to remove
these things to treat products, to burn things. There is no difference between something going on a DNR forestry plan versus something that's going on in the metro area. Just because it happens to be this tree gets removed out of a boulevard or something gets removed out of a lake, whether it's...
Representative Stasinski, just let me remind you, we did not adopt that amendment to get the money out of the outdoor heritage.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
I'm going to ask people...
I ask for a roll call.
I could roll it out of order, but I think we are going to do the roll call, and I would ask members to vote no.
Yeah, Madam Chair, so, you know, the reason why I brought this forward is because truly, you know, I feel because we're dealing with a trade secret, we're not allowed to be disclosed of how much the this particular plant is costing ratepayers because it's private, you know, and we understand that it is probably the, some of the most expensive energy in the state. You know, we just got done last session buying...
Stasinski, you did ask for a roll call, and we are in a, we're in a roll call.
Okay.
So let's do our roll call.
It's a debatable motion?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, okay. Madam Chair, I just want to speak to the fact that we need to be, I mean, I think you should approve this amendment. I think to be fair to the taxpayers and the ratepayers of the state, this is a common sense amendment that I think if this bill is to move forward, which I don't believe it should, that I think it's only fair. So,
clerk will take the roll. The chair votes no.
Representative Swazinski?
Aye.
Representative Mickham?
No.
Representative Baker? Representative Behrman? No. Representative Bowe?
Yes.
Representative Christensen?
No.
Representative Garofalo? Representative Halverson?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Mahoney? Representative Mecklen?
Yes.
Representative Stevenson?
It's 3-4-7 against the amendment is not adopted. Members, if this were bill were to come back in an omnibus bill, we would have great opportunity to have further discussion on it. And so I don't see any more. Representative Swazinski, would you like to have a final comment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I really believe this bill has a lot of flaws in it. I'd have liked to be able to talk to Representative Mahoney because I think he would maybe be able to have made some arguments of why or why not. But I truly believe that, you know, whatever conversations happen shouldn't happen in the omnibus bill. They should happen before that. And I'm going to move the table this bill so that we could take this bill up as a separate entity before it would be considered for an omnibus bill. And I would ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested on tabling. There is no discussion. The clerk will take the roll. The chair votes no.
Representative Swazinski.
Aye.
Representative Acomb.
No.
Representative Baker. Representative Behrman.
No.
Representative Bowe.
Yes.
Representative Christensen.
No.
Representative Garofalo. Representative Halverson.
No.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Mahoney? Representative Mecklen?
Yeah.
Representative Stevenson?
There are three ayes and seven noes. The amendment is not adopted. The bill is laid over, and we are adjourned for today. Thanks, members.